Morning, everybody. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. In his new book, the political scientist Lester Spence argues that over the last 40 years, black politics have been co-opted by neoliberalism. He says its pernicious influence has spread to black churches, hip-hop culture, and virtually every aspect of the African-American experience. The book is called Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. Dr. Spence is here to talk about it. Then, the next installment of our series, Living Questions, in which we explore the role of religion in the public sphere. Today, a conversation with clergy about prayer and politics in the age of ISIS. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Outside Mullingar at the Everyman Theater, and I'll have a year-end reflection on some of the artists we've lost in 2015. Nathan Sterner has the local headlines. Maryland Morning starts right after the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Breaking up big rocks on a chain gang. Breaking rocks and saving my time. Breaking rocks out there on a chain gang. Cause I've been convicted of crime. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terrible long to go.
On 881, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Good morning, everybody. The connotation of the term hustle run the gamut. Hustlers can be celebrated as high-energy, ambitious achievers or denigrated as con artists. People who hustle can be applauded for their tenacity and determination, while people who are said to lack a desire to hustle can be seen as deadbeats. In his new book, Dr. Lester Spence takes a close look at the notion of hustling and how our understanding of it is connected to neoliberalism and its influence on the politics of the African-American community. Spence makes a passionate and provocative argument that black politics have been co-opted by neoliberalism, whose beginnings he dates from the Nixon administration in the 1970s. The book is called Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. Lester Spence is an associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University. He joins me in the studio. Good morning. It's good to see you.
Oh, good morning. It's good to be here.
And happy holidays.
You too.
So let's start by defining neoliberalism, which you connect to its affection for the markets and letting the market run things.
Yes. So said simply, neoliberalism is just the idea that the market should structure every institution that we have, not just business ones, but non-business ones. And then there are a set of ideas about how we as individuals are supposed to behave. And that is where the concept of hustling comes from, because the standard, the perfect human under neoliberalism is the person who's an entrepreneur of him or herself. I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. That's a line from Jay-Z, and I think that gets it. And that distinguishes the populations that should get resources, you know, people who either can hustle or have the ability to hustle, and then people who shouldn't, who should have resources withheld from them. And those are the people who are unable to do so.
It's interesting because that term neoliberalism people tend to associate it without thinking about it with the left rather than the right, as opposed to neoconservatism, which of course, you know, the neocons are also big fans of the market.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And there is kind of a Democratish, to extent we can talk about that in Republican-Democrat terms. It's a bipartisan dynamic, right? So the turn starts in the 70s, but the person who really is responsible for kind of instantiating it or putting it or creating the policies that we associate it with it now is really Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that sort of triangulation, that so-called, you know, middle of the road.
Yeah, that third wave or that new way.
Yeah. And how about hustling, this notion of hustling? And of course, you know, on the one hand, say, well, if that guy really hustles, you know, he's going to get ahead and he deserves it because he has hustled and he's hustled better or more than, you know, the person next to him. Therefore, he's ahead and that's not a surprise and that's a good thing. But how are you thinking about hustling in general?
So one way to think about it is to look at labor productivity across time in comparison to wages. So labor productivity going back to 70 is skyrocketed. We've become increasingly more productive, but wages have basically flatlined and in fact have decreased a little bit, right? So that hustle thing is, and cost for a wide array of goods, of housing, education, has also skyrocketed. So we're consistently forced to work harder and harder and harder to generate more, but we're getting paid less. And then the safety net's pretty much dropped out. So we're talking about, you know, dwindling retirement funds, if we have them. And that's what that hustle is, that thing that kind of fills in the gap.
And so lay out your argument that this neoliberalism and this notion of hustling has worked to advance inequality, particularly for African Americans.
Yeah, so I say this all the time, if you plot a graph of inequality from 1929 to now, it's in the shape of a U. Really, really high levels of inequality in 1929. Really, really high levels now, but it dips in the middle, right? So it starts to uptick around 1970 or so, and that's when we see the neoliberal turn kind of taking shape, where the government says, okay, we want a range of institutions to actually become entrepreneurial. We want to kind of decrease the tax burden on high earners. We want to decrease the tax burden on corporations. We want to make cities act entrepreneurially. We want to make individuals act entrepreneurially. We want to replace welfare with workfare. And we want to basically replace the types of industrial jobs we used to have in places with Baltimore with prison. Right. That's basically what happens. Now, the thing is we think about this in racial terms, we can understand why black life has become more precarious under this turn. Right. We can totally unexplain it. But we cannot explain the fact that within black communities, there are also high levels of inequality. There are black people who get a lot of loot. There are black people who get nothing. And there's black people who are somewhere in the middle. How do you explain that? How do you explain that dynamic? You can't use racism for it.
Right. You say that racism explains only so much, but it doesn't go that far. And you're very harsh, actually, in this book about a number of, you know, leading black intellectuals. I mean, you take on Cornel West, you take on President Obama, the political establishment. You even at one point say perhaps we do ourselves a service by leaving prophets, even ones like Dr. King and public intellectuals in the past. I mean, that's some serious stuff, man. And is it just a matter of antiquated thinking? Or just is it empirical in that, you know, we've tried this entrepreneurial, injection of entrepreneurship in every aspect, in education, in religion, in, media, in everything. We've tried it, didn't work, and we got to just move to a different path?
Well, so take something like Obama's My Brother's Keeper program, which is about kind of making kids responsible, making black boys more responsible. We know that responsibilizing quote-unquote black boys isn't the thing that's actually driving all these problems that black boys and black girls tend to have. It's a structural dynamic, right? So it's not just that it's antiquated. It is that it just doesn't bear out. And in fact, these solutions make the problems worse. Now, somebody like Cornel West or Dr. West is funny because Dr. West ostensibly articulates himself as being on the left. He was on the front lines of Black Lives Matter, right? But the thing is the solution to this turn is democratic politics. And the politics that Cornel West supports, the politics that to a certain extent somebody like Martin Luther King represents, are actually anti-democratic, right? They go against the idea of organizing people on their interests, and then it doubles down on the idea that in order to get ourselves out of this, we need this black male leader who can speak and kind of charisma our way out of this dynamic.
You take on the black church for some of the same reasons. You say that the black church often pacifies rather than politicizes black people, black families, and people are politically organized, but they're not politically active. They're not acting politically. So what's that distinction?
Yeah, so what's happening is they're being mobilized for a different type of project. The prosperity gospel, really quickly, it argues that if you follow the Bible's precepts, you will not only be spiritually prosperous, you will be materially prosperous. And as a result of that gospel, we have a number of black pastors making basically the equivalent of CEO salaries, right? And that gospel has basically infected evangelical churches and has taken a specific form in black churches, and it's basically replaced the left-leaning liberation theology that was strong in the 60s.
Yeah, you mentioned that there are perhaps as many as eight, perhaps even more, clergy in the United States making something like 200 times more than what their congregants are making. Yeah. And that is that straight out of, you know, Wall Street CEO stuff.
Yes, Creflo Dollar out of Atlanta asked his parishioners for a $60 million plane, and he actually took that. He had to step back on that because he got so much criticism, but it was standard for him. His belief was that God actually placed him to in a moment where he can work as an intercessor, and if he doesn't have a $60 million plane, he can't bestow blessings on his churchgoers.
You talk about the role of entrepreneurship or the philosophy of entrepreneurship and neoliberalism as it affects education. Yeah. You're saying that in injecting all this entrepreneurship in education, that really sort of misses the point of what educating people means.
Yeah, so in this case, in that chapter, one of the things I do is we talk about public intellectuals. I think the most important public intellectual that nobody knows is Roland Fryer. Roland Fryer is a Harvard economist. I think the youngest African-American there to get tenure. And what he basically did was spend a significant amount of time rolling out neoliberal policies in education, you know, paying kids, for example, to get good grades, arguing that those type of policies were better than larger structural policies. And what his data finds persuasively is that this stuff doesn't work. But rather than say, okay, we need to rethink this and maybe think about structural changes, he and other actors like him double down on it. And we know that these have really, really horrific effects on the racial achievement gap and on the income achievement gap.
Really quickly, we just have a few seconds left. One of the solutions you point to is the Black Lives Matter movement. Where do you see hope in that movement?
This and Occupy Wall Street, we see people organizing for the first time in a while around racial inequality and around income inequality. And the only way to actually deal with this turn is to meet it head on through political organizing, through changing the apparatus of the state.
All right. Lots to think about in this book, and I look forward to it. And I hope folks read it and heed what you're saying. It's a really interesting read. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Lester Spence, his new book is called Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. It's published by Punctum Books. We've got a link to more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up a little later in the program, an imam, a rabbi, and a minister walk into a radio studio. This one, we'll talk about religious intolerance, politics, and prayer. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
On 881, I'm Tom Hall. It's time now for another installment in our monthly series, Living Questions, in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. As we enter this Christmas week, I've invited three religious leaders to discuss, among other things, a headline in the New York Daily News that caught my attention and the attention of a lot of other folks as well. It appeared earlier this month, the day after a husband and wife in San Bernardino, California, murdered 14 people at a holiday party. In the four corners of the tabloid newspaper, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, Rand Paul, and Paul Ryan are all quoted as saying that their prayers are with the victims of the massacre. In the middle of the page, in large block letters, the headline screams, "God isn't fixing this." The subheadline appears to make the case for stricter gun control measures. It says, "As latest batch of innocent Americans are left lying in pools of blood, cowards who could truly end gun scourge continue to hide behind meaningless platitudes." The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life reported earlier this year that more than 16% of Americans identify as unaffiliated with any particular faith. That's more than double the number who say they were unaffiliated as children. With fewer Americans embracing religious faith, has prayer in the nomenclature of the New York Daily News been relegated to, quote, meaningless platitudes? On the same day the Daily News published its headline, the New York Post published a headline that said simply, Muslim killers. Muslims have reported a sharp increase in incidents of anti-Islamic behavior since the attacks in Paris and San Bernardino. So if the polls are correct, religion plays less of a role it once did in the lives of Americans, but the case can be made that religion is playing more of a role in bigotry and intolerance in our society. Dr. Christopher Layton joins me in the studio. He's the executive director of the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. He's also an ordained Presbyterian minister. Safir Rab II is here as well. He's an imam and the CEO of Interculture, a consulting firm that advises public and private sector clients on matters of cultural competency and sensitivity. We're also joined by Rabbi Stephen Schwartz, who is the senior rabbi at Bethel Congregation in Pikesville and a board member of the ICJS. Gentlemen, welcome to you all. Thank you for coming in.
Great
Thank
to be
you.
Here.
Thanks for having
us. So, Safir Rab, let me start with you, and I want to pass this around the table. What do you make of this headline, God isn't fixing this?
God didn't start it. I think that the headline suggests, in a very sly way, that the Republicans that are running for president are attributing the fix to religion, and it is directly implying that religion is not the right answer. And I think it's really a political partisan expression more than it is a criticism of religion. But I think that for sure, prayer, when you get into the article, and the prayer is a symbol, prayer is an idea, is wrongly interpreted from the start. And if that is corrected, and the role of religious leaders toward that correction is appropriated correctly, then I believe the headline would have absolutely no basis.
Mm-hmm. Rabbi Schwartz, this, of course, is an age-old question, and when your congregants come to you with a question like this, or, you know, the question of if God is loving and God is good, how could God have allowed the Holocaust to happen? I mean, this is a question that the rabbis and scholars have been wrestling with for centuries. What do you tell them when they present this headline to you, God isn't fixing this, why not?
Why don't you just give me a hard question, Tom? We go on.
We start with the easy ones, yeah. Right.
I mean, the headline to me, it actually speaks to an old Jewish idea, which is essentially say your prayers, but then go out and do your work. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't wait around for God to take care of it. That's a responsibility that God has given us, with the tools, the intellect, the wisdom, all of the things that we can use to make the world the kind of world that God would want it to be. The question is, are we doing it or not? And unfortunately, all too often, we fail in that task.
And Chris Layton, I guess a lot of this has to do with different traditions and the teachings about what our personal relationship with God is. When massacres like this happen, the president just this year started saying, well, look, every time I mention gun control after one of these mass slayings, I'm told that I'm politicizing the issue. And he said finally this year, we should politicize this. This is a political issue. So here we have political leaders. Are they just spewing platitudes?
Well, in the first place, I want to amplify a point that Steve was making. The headline that said God isn't fixing this, in many respects, although it scandalizes many popular ears, the reality is this tradition of lamentation, this tradition of calling God to account, is part and parcel of many of the Psalms that have been around for 3,000 years. So that calling God to wake up, to be involved, to get active, to cajoling God to start acting like God, which in many respects strikes us as outrageous, is part of the tradition suggesting that one can bring one's entire self, including one's rage, to bear on the divine. That God is, if you will, big enough to handle whatever emotions and reactions we have to toss it. But one doesn't stop in that outrage. In a sense, one is called upon through prayer to do what is empirically seen as impossible, namely to go back into the past and repair it. Death and loss leaves an open wound, and it is the business of our religious traditions to make the leap into the past, coming to grips with the loss in all of its magnitude, and stitching up that open sore so that one does not get caught in anger, resentment, grievances that, it seems to me, is being disseminated throughout our culture right now. And so I think, indeed, our prayers need to be politicized so that we do not submit ourselves to a culture of fear.
Mm-hmm. Sophia Robb, when you're teaching and when your students are wrestling with these issues, what do you say about the role of prayer in Islam? Where what does one accomplish with prayer? Or is that even a bad way of framing it in terms of accomplishment or not?
Well, for sure, prayer is in itself an accomplishment, and it accomplishes many things. One of the great accomplishments of prayer is balance. It takes the psyche, and through regular attribution, regular recognition of the creator, of the source of life, the source of meaning, the source of purpose that is bigger than any of our current woes, our current circumstances, our current realities. The idea of reinforcing that awareness is achieved through prayer, is accomplished through prayer. And I like to echo the one point that Steve made, that yes, you know, in Islam, there's an encouragement that prayer and good works have to complement one another in order to express faith.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's I believe that's the greatest accomplishment of prayer.
Mm-hmm. And Steve Schwartz, you know, I personally believe, at least, that, you know, Dr. Carson, Senator Cruz, President Obama, Secretary of State Clinton are genuine and authentic when they say they pray, and when they pray fervently, and when their thoughts and prayers are with the victims of this disaster or that disaster. There's prayer in the liturgy. You have prayer in the shul and community, you know, on Friday nights and Saturday mornings. But then there's individual prayer. What is the Jewish teaching about this relationship with God and the nature of praying in the Jewish faith?
Commonly, Judaism understands prayer as being something that is more internally directed as opposed to externally directed. In other words, if we're saying the words or reaching out to God with a hope or an expectation, where do the words go? Where do our thoughts go? In the end, I'm not sure we really know, but through that exercise, we can maybe learn more about ourselves, who we want to be, and how we want to interact with the world. And through that process, then, you know, there you can find a sense of peace, you can find a sense of healing, and there, I think prayer can be transformative, but it works more internally than externally.
Rabbi Stephen Schwartz is a senior rabbi at Beth El Congregation. Sophia Robb II is here. He's an imam and the CEO of Interculture. Dr. Christopher Layton joins us as well. He's the executive director of the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies and an ordained Presbyterian minister. This is Living Questions on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Chris Layton, when incidents like Paris, like San Bernardino, like Newtown, like Charleston, when these occur, the question comes up about what the role of organized religion is in terms of its responsibility for these actors. Is the Catholic Church responsible for Mr. Deere, who goes into a Planned Parenthood site in Colorado Springs? Or is the black church responsible for violence in black neighborhoods around the country? Is, you know, are Muslims responsible for Muslims acting in the name of Islam, creating acts of violence? How should we be framing those questions? Where does the responsibility for these organized religions lie?
Well, in one sense, the responsibility resides in the individual who commits the acts, and that individual needs to be held accountable. But it seems to me, at least my tradition wants to make another move as well. It wants to argue that in some sense we are responsible for each other, and that the act of an individual reflects a larger problem within the culture and the society, the public at large. And it is the responsibility of each of our traditions, each of our communities, to make sure that we do not allow toxic understandings to be disseminated, to be spread around. And what I mean by that is, it's so easy in the wake of a tragedy, a horror of the sorts that we've been treated to of late, to try to divide the world up into they're the good guys and they're the bad guys. And we better arm ourselves to defend ourselves from the bad guys. Well, in my tradition, there's a sense of saying, you know what, that divide between so-called good guys and bad guys is an artificial and mistaken notion. We belong to each other. And therefore, it is essential for us to recognize and to see our face, even in the face of those that we want to brand as criminals. Therefore, we must take responsibility for finding whatever it is in our traditions that can be used and abused in the service of hate and disarm it.
Safir Rab, preliminary data reported in the New York Times just yesterday for 2015 found 71 reported cases of vandalism, harassment, and threats, with 29 of those occurring since the assaults in France against mosques and Islam in general, Muslims in particular, around the United States. When you talk to your students and talk about this notion of assimilation into American society, assimilation and creating an atmosphere of respect and tolerance, what are you advising them? What are you saying? Because they're clearly worried, and they clearly have a reason to be worried.
Well, first, I don't talk about assimilation into American society. I live it. I express it. I am the result of it. Meaning, when we look at the origin of Islam in America, we really see an Islamic expression rooted in social justice and human rights. We don't see something that is given to wanting to hurt people that is antithetical to what American Islam is, what it's always been. And so there's no lift to persuade the identity into accepting America. It built America. It was kidnapped from Africa and placed in servitude in America. That is the expression of our history, and that is the fact. To have the media dominate the airwaves with this expression of imported Islam that wants to hurt people, that's a foreign concept. It's a concept that doesn't fly well in the inner city, where people across faiths, and by the way, never before have we seen so many faiths coming together to help the world in its troubles and the history of the world. But I'll say that in the inner city, Muslims are known as people to repair social problems, not people who want to hurt folks. So when disproportionate attention is given to wackos that spring up in the face of things that happen in France, it would serve America better to give more attention to the way people are cooperating to help social concerns and not the destructive ones.
Mm-hmm. Steve Schwartz, it strikes me as a little interesting or ironic, at least, that as religious intolerance seems to have been on the increase, a steady increase, and I think, you know, a candidate like Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, who've also suggested very similar things to what Mr. Trump has suggested in terms of barring Muslims entry in the country. It's interesting that's a manifestation of a rise in religious intolerance at the same time that the number of people who are identifying as religious is going down,
Does that strike you as weird as it strikes me?
I think there's an irony there, but in some ways, to me, whether it's about religion, whether it's about racism, I mean, one of the things I keep going back to is how powerful rhetoric is and how dangerous rhetoric can be, and I think we're coming to terms with that in a new way. You know, that may be one of the reasons why religion has become less popular, because there's been a lot of anti-religious rhetoric over the last decade or so. So maybe folks who are on the fence would say, I'm going to step out of my church. I'm not going to go to my mosque. I don't want to go to my synagogue. There's no real reason. I don't get anything from it. Plus, there could be trouble there anyway, so I'm just going to stay out of the game at this point. But in terms of remarks that Trump has made, the power of rhetoric, what it can bring in terms of danger into culture, into society, it's scary. It's a scary time. Jewish community just spent some time reflecting and recollecting about the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin's 20 years ago now, and the bed that was made so that something like that could happen largely came out of a religious community with dangerous rhetoric.
Chris Layton, one of the distinctions that the president and other people have made about the so-called radical jihadists who are committing these acts, be they here in America or elsewhere, is that they have a complete willingness to die, that they think that death is actually a step up and it's a better deal than being alive. Is there any distinction in that interpretation of the Quran between that and the Christian perspective on death and the afterlife?
Well, I think both of our traditions want to argue that death does not have the last word, and they want to encourage and inspire a level of courage and fortitude to stick up for and stand strong in the face of what is seen as injustice and oppression. Martyrdom, of course, can be twisted and turned in directions that make it an enormously dangerous category. And so, in large measure, what I would want to say to that segment of the population that's opted out of religion altogether is that they are depriving themselves of an opportunity to wrestle with the tradition and to retrieve and recover the voices of their ancestors with whom they can argue and perhaps even learn something.
Well, we have learned a good bit this morning, and I appreciate all three of you coming in, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Safiya Rab II is an imam and the CEO of Interculture, a consulting firm here in Baltimore. Rabbi Stephen Schwartz is the senior rabbi at Beth El Congregation in Pikesville and a member of the board of the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Christopher Layton is the executive director of the ICJS and an ordained Presbyterian minister. This has been another discussion in our series, Living Questions, in which we explore all aspects of the role of religion in the public sphere. Come to our website, wipr.org/livingquestions, for more. I'm Tom Hall. We're delighted that you've joined us this morning from Maryland. Morning. Lots more coming up after a break for the news. Theater critic Jay Wynn Russick reviews the new show at Baltimore's Everyman Theater. First, here's Nathan.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. A couple of weeks ago, Nathan and I had a great time with the resident dialects coach for the Everyman Theater. He taught us how to say a line from the Everyman's current production. The play is called Outside Mullingar, and it takes place in Ireland. Gary Logan, the dialects coach, taught us how to say a line from the show with the proper Mullingarian accent. The line was, by the way, "The problem is there's just not enough air in the world to suit me, and there never has been." Well, our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick, has been to the Everyman to hear actors who can actually do a good Mullingarian dialect. Here's her review.
John Patrick Shanley. A playwright with that name might be expected to write plays with Irish settings, Irish characters, Irish themes, Irish music. Not Shanley. He didn't want to be pegged an Irish-American playwright. Then, this author of the screenplay of the Italian-American-themed movie Moonstruck gave in to his roots and wrote Outside Mullingar, his 2014 play set in the rural outskirts of a town 50 miles northwest of Dublin. It's been a happy homecoming. Outside Mullingar is among the most produced plays at American regional theaters this season. One of those is Everyman Theater, where Donald Hicken has directed an endearing Baltimore, Washington premiere. It's not just the setting that situates outside Mullingar squarely in the Irish tradition. Shanley has captured the Irish gift of gab, its mellifluousness, its humor, and its morbidity. The play begins when a father and his middle-aged son return from a funeral. "It took me back to the last time he died," the father says, launching into a story that's as funny as it is sad. The son, Anthony, has invited the widow and daughter of the deceased to stop by. Father and son have certain things in common with mother and daughter, as we begin to discover when Will Love as the crotchety father and Helen Hedman as the infirm mother discuss old age.
It's an awful thing to get old.
I know. It happened to me.
You're a girl.
I was this morning, but now I'm old.
These senior citizens share more than just being up in years. His son, Anthony, and her daughter, Rosemary, grew up together, their neighbors. But a dispute about the right-of-way to his farm has driven a wedge between the families. That, and the fact that Rosemary has held a grudge against Anthony since she was 6. Beth Hilton's Rosemary is full of gumption. Her mother calls her a bulldog, and she not only has that tenacity, she bullies Anthony and his dad. In Rosemary's first verbal skirmish with Tim Getman's Anthony, Hilton stands with her hands on her hips, and when that's not defiant enough, she steps up on a stool to lord it over him. She insists he challenge his father's plan to sell the farm out from under him.
But you have to push back, man, now and then, or they'll eat you alive, the people of this world. You can't let people, Tony or no one, destroy your chance. Go in there and face them down.
Don't like a fight.
Who does?
Half of Ireland.
Unlike Hilton's gutsy Rosemary, Getman's Anthony is reticent and a tad strange. He's one of those lanky men who doesn't know where to look or what to do with his hands. Yet, you know Anthony and Rosemary are destined for each other. Outside Mullingar is that kind of peace. How they get together, if they get together, is the substance of the play. There are many lovely touches at Everyman. The evocative green landscape painted on barn siding panels in Daniel Ettinger's set. The Celtic-flavored incidental music composed by Philip Owen. The soft and mostly steady Irish inflections coached by Gary Logan. The performances are so lovingly detailed, you'd swear there was a family resemblance between Will Love and Tim Getman. The evening's most touching scene is their last one together, when father tells son how he finally found joy. There also appears to be a family resemblance between Helen Hedman and Beth Hilton. Miss Hilton, in particular, has a knack for thoroughly transforming herself with each role she plays. At a little more than 90 minutes, Outside Mullingar is a slight play. It has the tenderness of Moonstruck, but lacks the social consciousness and topicality of John Patrick Shanley's other well-known work, the Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Doubt. Still, Outside Mullingar explores some broad themes: family heritage, moving beyond the past, finding your place in the world, and accepting love. In its modest way, it'll increase your own appreciation of your world and the people around you.
Outside Mullingar is at Baltimore's Everyman Theater in the Bromo Tower Arts and Entertainment District until January 10th. We've got a link to ticket information on our website. Come to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick shares her take on the theater scene most Monday mornings here on Maryland Morning. We'll hear from Judy 2 weeks from today when she kicks off the new year with a review of the new musical by Steve Martin at the Kennedy Center. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. As the year comes to a close, I'd like to take a moment to pause and remember some of the people in our community who we lost in 2015. Each of them was an important part of the social and cultural fabric of our community, and each, in his or her own way, enlivened and enriched Baltimore and beyond with grace and graciousness. I was blessed to know all of them. Two titans of the theater community took their final bow this year. Peter Kullman, the charismatic and longtime executive director of Center Stage, and the Everyman Theater's gifted dramaturg Naomi Greenberg-Sloven, both devoted themselves to making theater come alive for audiences young and old. Peter and Naomi needed only to smile and light up their eyes to get you hooked on a play and to remind you of theater's transformative power. Lou Cedrone of the Baltimore Sun, who was a fixture in the audience at Center Stage and Everyman, wrote for decades with passion and pluck about movies and the stars who made the magic. He wrote and reported with humility and integrity and a boyish and infectious fascination with how actors can lift us up and tell us a lot about ourselves. Carol Seibel was an indomitable force in local philanthropy, with a special place in her heart for the Baltimore School for the Arts. Carol's mark on that fine institution and other good causes in Baltimore will be felt for years to come. She was a forceful advocate for generations of talented kids. When Dr. Levi Watkins was a talented kid, he drove Martin Luther King Jr. back and forth from church. And when he grew up, he became a groundbreaking physician and a precedent-setting icon at Johns Hopkins Medicine. He was an arts lover and an artist of the possible. Finally, the classical music world lost one of its most fiery talents this year. Maurice Murphy was equally at home in a concert hall or on a church organ bench, and he played everything from Negro spirituals to Mozart arias with elegance, commitment, and unbridled love. Maurice and I played a lot of concerts together, and every one of them was revelatory and joyful. It's been a tough and challenging year for Charm City. Let's remember that for all the problems we have to fix, we also have the legacies of so many selfless and tireless people whose boundless imagination and ability were so often employed in the service of making life in our city better. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening.